The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Samuel Gibbs. On this week's show,
there is often a lot of fear and reticence about robots and kind of the unknown. And part of the reason that Atomo looks the way it does and moves the way it does is to help put people at ease.
I speak to Vicky Hood from Honda about its friendly robot pal, Asmo, and why such humanoid machines might in time become as common as household pets. Plus, myself and the tech team will be discussing why Lindsay Lohan is suing over the alleged use of her image in Grand Theft Auto, the rise of DIY text interactive game-making software Twine, and whether kids should be taught about digital copyright infringement in school. Get them while they're young. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me this week to share their wisdom, wit, and infinite knowledge, Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur.
Yeah, infinite knowledge, that's me.
Technology reporter Alex Hearn.
So I'm the wit?
And gaming and digital culture writer Lee Alexander.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To kick off this week's show, we turn to our story by our own esteemed colleague, Guardian's games editor, Keith Stewart, on the increasingly fractious legal battles between the famous and game studios who allegedly use their likeness in computer games without consultation or reward for the people involved. Keith joins us down the line. Keith, what has managed to bring Lindsay Lohan together with former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega?
Well, unfortunately, it isn't a celebrity master chef. Both of them are engaged in, early in engagement of lawsuits against two different video game publishers. Noriega has launched a lawsuit against Activision for his portrayal as himself, essentially, in the game Call of Duty Black Ops 2, which he is claiming that damages his reputation, and also he wasn't consulted on the depiction and he's not making anything from it. Similarly, Lindsay Lohan is actually suing Rockstar. She says one of the characters in the game, a kind of ditzy, slightly drunken celebrity actress, is actually based on her, using very specifically a photo that was taken of her in 2007 as their kind of influence. So both of them are claiming that their likenesses have been used in games without permission, and they effectively want cash.
So we're talking likenesses here. How like their own characters are they? I mean, we're talking separated at birth here.
Well, I mean, both of them are actually very slightly different cases. In the Lindsay Lohan case, It's not her. The character is called Lacey Jonas, and yeah, there are superficial similarities in that GTA character is a young actress. You encounter her a couple of times in the game. She has to be rescued from the paparazzi. So obviously there are parallels with Lindsay Lohan, as there are probably parallels with a lot of young actors in Hollywood. So that's kind of slightly more tenuous, although Lindsay Lohan has just filed a new 67-page document to the courts over in America to add, kind of substantiate her claim against Rockstar, using lots of new evidence about the ways that she says they've used her image in very kind of explicit terms. With Noriega, he actually appears as Noriega in the game. There's a couple of missions where you play a couple of CIA operatives who have to track down Noriega, and it's kind of semi based on fact, but very heavily fictionalized fact. And he begins as a kind of CIA shadow operative, Noriega, but then he betrays the CIA, and then you have to track him down. So, I mean, there are kind of very vague likenesses to real life, but he is kind of portrayed as Noriega. There's no getting away from that. I don't think, you know, Activision would claim he isn't. He is that character. So they've kind of fictionalized him. But their argument is, well, we're using him as an historic character. He's only in the game for a few seconds, barely 1% of the game. And and he's not a playable character. So they say he's a very small part of it. But, it's a very ambiguous area.
The interesting thing seems to be that in films, generally, I believe the settled law is that if it's based on fact, you don't actually have a right to your own life story. someone, if the fact's already out there and they don't involve you in collecting it, you have no real right to say, hey, you can't film my life story. The issue, the oddity seems to be that this is about likenesses. And obviously, if someone doesn't star in a film about them, you're not using their image. You're using the image of someone else playing them. And the games are this odd thing where you can get someone involved in a game and scan them and photograph them and get them to do the motion capture. Or you can have exactly the same person and try and do as well as you can with that without their being involved at all. And is that where this blurry line is with Noriega?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely about the idea of representation, about basically in the US and lots of other countries, individuals are given legal rights over their own image and to control it and how they are represented in fictional media, in materials of fictional nature. So this is what both Lindsay Lohan and Noriega are actually putting their lawsuits in for. So it's about representation of their image. I mean, there are lots of things bound up with this. Like, there is obviously in the US the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech, and that is particularly protected by something called transformation or use of transformative use, which is a test that's applied to when real life characters are portrayed in fiction. So, has the fiction maker, has the game developer, has the film director made enough of a transformative use for it to be a fiction? Obviously, you would say that Rockstar has a really, really good case here because they don't name the character Lindsay Lohan. So even if she has like a spitting image of that character, there's enough of a transformative use there to presumably protect them from this lawsuit. With Noriega, it's an interesting difference in that it's obviously him. And last year, EA, Electronic Arts, had to make a multi-million dollar payout to college athletes because they were represented in a college American football game without their permission, and the athlete's case was, well, they've taken our likenesses and our names, and there's no transformative use because these characters are effectively us, and they won. So that's an interesting precedent. So, however sort of bizarre we see this case with Noriega, I think it's going to be kind of interesting, although Activision have now recruited as one of their co-counsels Rudy Giuliani, the ex mayor of New York, who's now running a legal firm, and he's kind of very vociferous in describing this case as a kind of fallacious and sort of legally revolting try by Noriega to get money. So, I mean, it's incredible that the number of kind of quote-unquote celebrities that are lining up here. You know, who would have thought a few years ago that we'd have Rudy Giuliani in the court fighting Noriega? It's kind of like something out of a bizarre hallucination.
my feeling is that you're reckoning that Lohan has not much chance, but Noriega does.
I'm not sure. I don't think he does. I mean, there are lots of complications in the Noriega case, apart from the fact that he's obviously currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for human rights abuses and other violations. So, and he's not a US citizen either. And also, I was speaking to a couple of entertainment lawyers about this case for a feature I wrote on it earlier this week. And what it may well come down to in the end is finance. And Activision has a heck of a lot of money and has been here before. It has had problems with its Guitar Hero games and how they've used likenesses of pop stars and rock stars.
For Keith's feature and many more gaming stories, head to theguardian.com/technology. One of the consequences of our fast-paced digital revolution is the almost inevitable clash between technology and the often slow law of the land. One of the most thorny being the right and responsibilities consumers have when it comes to the content we buy or rent. What can we copy and share, and what should be off-limits? This week, the Conservative MP for Hove and Portslade, Mike Weatherly, in his role as the Prime Minister's policy advisor on intellectual property, suggested that copyright education and awareness should start with kids in school. Alex, you wrote the story of Weatherly's report. How early is he suggesting we start?
So Weatherly, his job as part of Cameron's government is essentially to try and crack down on copyright infringement however he can. And he talks about doing it in three ways. They They want to do, you know, a carrot and stick approach, which are the first two. So firstly, with the stick, they want to actually take a look at the penalties for copyright infringement, enforce them better. The carrot approach is the opposite. It's encouraging the creative industries to actually offer up their content in ways that are, you know, amenable to people actually paying for it. But the third approach is on the side of that, and it's education. Essentially, he's worried that a generation of kids are growing up without thinking that copyright's an issue, or even without understanding, you know, that it's in any way wrong or seen as wrong to illegally download music or to, you know, watch videos hosted on YouTube that aren't paid for, and so on and so on. The suggestion is that it would start at early years, that it's really getting them while they're young. It's from the minute they start school, kids should in some way be told, hey, you know what? All of that music that you listen to on YouTube, make sure it's officially uploaded. Otherwise, the poor artist isn't being paid for their work. It's the sort of thing that people have been talking about for quite some time, because there really is a disconnect. That's not something imaginary. Kids simply don't see why, if they can find something on YouTube, if they can find something on Tumblr, why it's not okay to use it. The problem that Mike Weatherly will have is that it's quite hard to explain to a child how you can actually tell the difference half the time. If you're just going on YouTube and searching for Taylor Swift's new single, there are results. If you click on the results, they play. There's no warning saying this is an illegal result. There's not even, you know, much clarity, if there is an official one, that it's actually official. Sometimes it might come from the artist's official YouTube channel, but you're already saying, if that's the case, you're trying to teach kids, hey, you know, you've got to make sure that if it says Taylor Swift on the channel, that it's her official one and not a fan channel, because it's going to be difficult, but, you know, they have to do it.
It's certainly a lot different from the days when, if you wanted to get a DVD, you could either go to the shop on the corner, or you could have the person who would come around while you're at lunch and get a, you know, offer you a DVD out of a bag, or alternatively, the car boot sales was definitely, and it was only sort of printed in three colours rather than four, and that sort of thing. I mean, in that sense, the difficulty of telling what is real content and, yeah, well, what is legitimate content and what isn't, is a lot more difficult. But though equally, do you have the question of, well, which is always raised of, you know, so does that matter? You know, is it about monetizing content, or do you monetize the stuff around the content and accept that the content is really hard to corral, because it's all just ones and zeros?
There's so little barrier right now between what we consume and the act of purchasing it. I don't even know sometimes whether what I'm listening to or looking at is legitimate or, you know, plenty of content is available for free as a promotional strategy. So it's actually, I think, fairly sophisticated knowledge to expect children to have to be able to determine, you know, what their rights protection on what it is they're enjoying is.
Yeah.
What kind of age are we talking about here? I mean, are we talking 5-year-olds? Because, I mean, as soon as you have internet access, you start finding this
stuff.
Yeah,
and you know, Weatherly, it's currently not a very fleshed out proposal, let's say. This is Mike Weatherly has produced a 60-page document looking at everything from education to, he also wants the BBC to be doing more to promote it. He wants the government to make its own law on copyright easier to find. But when it comes to education, he's talking about everything from early years to university. What doesn't get fleshed out is what it actually entails. So some of it, if it really is early years, it could be as simple as, you know, if a teacher is using educational materials in class, mentioning that, hey, when I'm showing you this video, you know, this is an official video. This isn't just some pirated video. But at the same time, some of the examples that have actually made it into the public domain of this sort of thing aren't quite so nuanced. The Recording Industry Association of America, America's version of the BPI, produced its own educational materials for schools in 2009. And that was very definitely, I mean, it was what you'd call propaganda. It was them making it very clear to kids that piracy is bad, don't do it, it harms the industry, which is perhaps an uncontroversial message, but at the same time, kids weren't really learning much from it other than don't download music. And that was back in the easy days when piracy, when breaking the law on copyright online, did involve, you know, going to a relatively shady site, downloading software that let you download. You know, these days, it's a whole other ballgame of what is legitimate and illegitimate, when you can't police what kids are looking at on Tumblr and on YouTube. You can't even explain to them how to tell the difference between pirated material and not. So it's going to be very hard to write a curriculum which even hits them over the head with the blunt message of don't pirate things.
When I was a kid in America downloading music, I remember the record industry crackdown and the significant legal consequences that we teens were threatened with, you know, should we happen to download music. And in a way, there was a sort of PR war for legitimate music that I don't think was won via crackdowns. You know, artists who said, hey, please pay for our music became figures of fun in a sense, which obviously I don't think was the result that anybody wanted. So do you think it is possible to educate people about the benefits of legitimate content consumption without some kind of incentive on the content end to show people that what they're consuming is legitimate, to reward them in some way for participating in an official channel? Do you think that we're just going to have to get more savvy about sources and looking at the content itself?
Right. I mean, that's the tricky one. I kind of think this is where the carrot and stick and education thing comes in. If this is going to work, they have to work together. It can't just be hitting kids over the head with a blunt message. The message has to come in line with the industry going, yeah, you know what, right now we're not really offering any reason to care. Like, we're telling people it's right and wrong, but they don't really need to know whether what they're doing is right and wrong. And anyway, the legal and illegal products look almost exactly the same. They're videos on YouTube with a 3-minute. One of them might have an unskippable ad in front, but that's not really better.
The worst thing is that it might actually be the official one, which has the unskippable ad, and it's the one which is, you know, on the thing where someone just downloaded and re-uploaded it, which doesn't have the add-on. In that sense, it's rather like DVDs, where you get all the, you know, where the real DVD has the unskippable ad in front saying, don't pirate DVDs, which really annoys people whenever they come across, whereas the hooky DVD doesn't.
The most recent Blu-ray disc I had a 2-minute unskippable ad for Twix in front of it. Which just, like, I was watching it going, ha, this is why people pirate.
See, the advertising worked, though. You remember the brand.
I remember the brand. I now have involuntary hatred for the brand stopping me watching movies.
I've been doing a video series studying vintage computer games from the early 80s when things were on floppy disks. And there was, of course, the don't copy that floppy slogan. And some of the adventure games I'm playing have sort of hilarious plot diversions where you meet the developers of the game, and they explain to you that they are hurt by the fact that you've stolen the game, if in fact you have stolen it. And so I guess this has been a problem since the 80s, and empathy is one approach.
I mean, that's kind of glorious. I wonder if we can just do that. Get Taylor Swift into primary schools across the country.
Tell children that they're hurting her steal her music. Yeah,
I think
that
this would
work.
Make you pirate her music even more. Wouldn't
she might
she
come to my
personal
school
visits. I mean, it's like the there was a period when there were MP3s on Napster, I think, which had Madonna in the middle of them saying, don't fucking pirate music. and these became prized. You know, hey, Madonna's swearing at me.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trouble is very much that the content is just expanding. I mean, I met Aaron Levy, who's the chief executive of Box, this morning, and he was saying, you know, we're now in a position where it used to be if you wanted some content, you had to go down to the corner store, you had to buy the film or whatever, you had to get the VHS, you put it into the... Now you've got a situation where you've got sort of 2.however many billion people who've got mobile phones who can connect to the internet, who can see your content straight away, you know, as soon as they want it. So when you get to that sort of situation, the question about, you know, is it copyrighted, is it, you know, real, becomes really, really difficult to police, let alone to educate people about.
Do you think the government's pushing towards a computing curriculum about coding and the appreciation of the amount of work that goes into producing, you know, programs and things like that? Could this kind of copyright infringement be blended in with that?
I think it would fit, but it's also actually, I mean, that curriculum brings up one of the real questions that Weatherly will have to answer even when this curriculum is put in place, which is it a blunt tool to stop copyright infringement, or are we actually trying to teach kids the nuanced reality of copyright? I mean, the big question will be whether ideas like fair dealing are put in this curriculum. What Lee is doing with her video series Let's Play Lo-Fi is, you know, that is fair use recording of these games. You have not tracked down the owner of every adventure game and asked if you can do it.
I hope it's fair use. I mean, I really don't know. They're old games that are no longer able to be sold, and I, you know, the hunch or the assumption is that the creators of the content would appreciate, you know, this preservation effort. They're available freely on emulation websites. I don't know if they're legal. And so it's like, I don't know, and I work in tech.
Right.
How am I going to teach this to children?
And then, I mean, coding, one of the famous things about coding, the minute you get beyond absolute beginner, is the way you code isn't really sitting down and writing lines of code. It's sitting down, finding other lines of code that people have already written that do roughly what you want to do, and using them in your program. If we're in one classroom teaching kids that stealing is bad, always pay people for what they do, and then in another classroom going, hey, you've got a coding problem, Google, see if someone has done it that way, see if you can adapt it, and then slot it in.
Or even more, you know, okay, copy down these questions from this book and,
right,
and do
exactly.
them. Or, you know, or here's a photocopied set of questions from
but
from
don't
this
worry,
textbook.
This photocopied set of questions is okay. Because, oh, no, wait, we haven't been teaching you the nuanced realities of copyright. We've just been teaching you.
Yeah, like so much of tech philosophy and tech leadership focuses on things being free and open source.
Exactly.
So it can be quite confusing for young people, I think.
And so, I mean, this nuance is... It's almost certainly not going to be baked in from the start if it's a curriculum which is focused around reducing copyright infringement. But that's a real shame, because actually what kids need to know is, hey, copyright's nuanced. On the one hand, yeah, if you see a music video on YouTube which is clearly sort of videotaped from a TV screen, probably illegal. But there's shades of grey between that and just walking into a shop and buying a CD single. Remember that?
Are you accusing Sam of buying CD singles?
I bought a CD single twice.
I've purchased one or two CD singles myself.
I can't remember the last time I actually bought a CD. So for the latest on copyright infringement and all else to do with content, the internet and everything, go to theguardian.com/technology. A key part of web culture is the ability to do it yourself. Hack, chop, change and create something that is one individual's creation, but shared with a wider community. Hardware like the Raspberry Pi and software like Minecraft have been high-profile examples, but the gaming community might just have the next big thing in DIY. It's a simple, text-based game-making program called Twine. And Lee, you've written lots about this. Tell us what Twine is.
Twine is a free tool for designing projects using hypertext, which is a fancy word for links. So it's a text-based game-making tool that actually wasn't even originally designed to write games at all. I interviewed the creator recently, and he said he hoped it would, you know, help people with their writing projects or maybe their novels. But a number of independent game designers were attracted to Twine because it has no barrier to entry. It requires no coding skill at all. And... people, if you can write it down, if you can type it up, then you can create it in a designed space, which makes Twine particularly revolutionary because games are traditionally fairly limited in terms of who is invited to make them and about what. So the low barrier to entry for Twine and the fact that it's free to use and easy to learn attracted a lot of women, minorities, people who had never thought of making something before, to start developing their own projects using Twine and sort of revolutionizing the way we think about games with these unique spaces that are imagined in text and connected by links. And it requires no coding skill at all, so it's very democratic. And many people who never thought they could design a project before are now reimagining the definition of gaming through this text tool.
So, I mean, who is Twine aimed at? It produces a text game. Just give us an overview of what a text game is, because many people, myself included, have never really played text games. So what...
Well, some of the earliest games ever made back in the 80s, such as the one that I explore in my video series Lo-Fi Let's Play, text can be used to describe environments, to indicate puzzles or challenges that are around you. For example, you know, you're in a room and you see a box here and it's dark. Immediately you have to think about, you know, even though you've only read those words on the screen, your imagination fires up and you start thinking about how you're going to act in that space. In traditional text-based games, they were parser-based, which means it was an interface in which you would type commands such as, you know, open box or check my inventory or go north or go south. Twine actually takes it a step further because there's no parser required. The writer of the game provides for responses to the player that they can then click on in the form of links. So, you know, you would see a menu of choices before you and you could click on one. Or, you know, it could be like a choose your own adventure story with a much more familiar structure. So there's many different ways that people can design spaces using text only.
Wasn't one of the things about those early games, you know, adventure and things, that the parser was part of it, was trying to, you know, you'd say, open boxes, say, can't open box. You say, pick box up and drop it on the floor. And so, okay, the box has fallen open. Yeah, it's the parsing was part of the whole game in that sense, was trying to figure out what the hell you had to do to the box.
Yes, and there's communities of people who've been creating text games for years since then and who are still creating text games that the debate rages on about the value of the parser, whether it's a fun conversational puzzle or a barrier to players enjoying it. By eliminating the parser, it eliminates coding work and it eliminates barriers to entry for people who've never seen that type of game before and who aren't interested in dealing with that particular type of puzzle.
So, I mean, I get from the description, and I've played a few Twine games, I get from the description that you can easily make a choose-your-own adventure-style game, like you said. So you have a wall of text and then a couple of options for the player to click on below that. Can it go further than that? That seems interesting and obviously a way of making a very simple style of game, but it would be interesting if you could do more with it than that.
You can do more. It's possible to learn to implement macros that make Twine more robust and allow for a bit more complicated things to be done with it. You can embed sound in pictures. One of my favorite Twine games ever, released in 2012, it's called Howling Dogs, and it's by the artist Porpentine. And it is set in a single room where you are sort of hooked to a machine and you go through your daily exercises. It's a bit 1984-ish. And as you go, as you use the machines that are in the room, emotional flashbacks happen. And despite the fact that all I'm ever doing is reading words on the screen, because of the way it's written, the sense of my environment is realized quite strongly. I know that one room is connected to another room. I know that if I interact with this machine, I'm going to have this kind of type of vision. And I feel a sense of space quite strongly, especially because as the game progresses, the environment degrades around you. You start to see things happening in the room, and it's all text, but the way that it is structured allows for a really vivid sense of place. And many, many Twine games are experimenting with sense of place. They have a distinct geography to them. They may have what we would call game systems more traditionally. There are a number of games where there's health that you can lose or objects that you can pick up. So even though it's just text and hyperlinks, depending on what the designer does with it, the experience can be really interesting for the player.
So would you say that those sort of text-based games, that those are more like novels or books than, say, the sort of GTA, all the other, Assassin's Creed, all those sorts of things, the very visual console games, that those are more like films? Is there a classification?
I think it defies comparison to other media, but you are right in that a Twine game is very, very different from a traditional video game with a controller and a vivid graphical experience where the mode of interaction is pushing buttons and committing actions. It's true that the mode of interaction in a Twine game is probably reading and thinking and imagining more than acting and reacting and using your reflexes or your eyes.
I mean, you've hinted at it because the original concept of Twine was to help story writers and things like that. Can Twine be taken beyond gaming? Is it just limited to gaming?
Oh, absolutely not limited to gaming at all. It could be used by someone trying to plot a novel out and explore different plot branches. Imagine if you could, lay out the critical path for a story that you want to tell and then create different branches and see how it flows together when you click each one. I think that's how the creator of Twine originally envisioned the tool being used. So it is absolutely not limited to gaming at all. I bet you could use it for a presentation. I've seen people make presentations at gaming conferences that use Twine and where the audience calls out what option to click on. So it's very flexible. Almost anyone can use it, and it's a wonderful introduction to coding concepts without requiring coding per se.
So would you say Twine is a fantastic first step for kids?
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about the computing curriculum. It's very much at the forefront of in the UK at the moment. So should kids just grab Twine and go?
Yes, absolutely. Through Twine, kids can become introduced to entry-level HTML, which will help them learn to build websites and understand fundamentally how websites work. They can understand cause and effect by having one option that they build lead to another conclusion. You can learn coding concepts very easily through Twine, and it has a visual interface. Like, you'll see how the different boxes or sections that you've created interconnect. You can look at cause and effect relationships between things you've created. So I definitely think it would be an ideal entry-level tool. When I was a kid in the 80s, I learned basic programming and moving a terrapin turtle around the room on the floor. I don't know if anybody out there remembers the terrapin turtle, but you could teach
logo.
Logo, yeah, it was logo. Yeah, you could teach it to draw with a pen, and this, I think, is a little more accessible than that. So I would love to see Twine used in schools for kids' projects or for to teach them web design or game design.
I mean, in terms of how easy it is, our very own Mary Hamilton, who works in Guardian Australia and is soon moving to Guardian America, when she moved out to Australia, she decided to teach herself how to code, and by code that she meant use Twine. And she has on her personal website a wonderful Twine game about the difficulty of packing up your life and moving to another continent. It really is that easy. That was the first thing I believe she'd ever made.
I think that's a really important thing about Twine, is that many of the games that you'll see people making in Twine are about their personal experiences. As you described, Mary's game was about something difficult she'd been through. The game that I discussed, Howling Dogs, is about some difficult emotions that the creator was having. I think people, you know, maybe there's something about the text format that encourages people to approach it as a diary. Maybe it's the fact that people are picking up games and tech who wouldn't have thought it was for them before. So themes and emotions that we don't commonly see visited through games are coming out through Twine games, because, you know, what have these people been waiting to express, and what would they have expressed if they'd known how to code all this time? So I think there's something almost beautiful and political about that, in that we're hearing stories that haven't been told before. We're hearing about different types of experiences because of Twine. I've learned a lot about other people through the Twine games they've made. And I think it's a beautiful thing for gaming in general, for something like that to exist that is accessible and easy to give to someone else. Like I've made a Twine game that was a sort of joke gift card for my partner. And like, what a beautiful role for gaming to play in society as a tool for expression and empathy and communication. And I'm so excited that Twine's enabled that in such a big way.
I wonder whether anybody's managed to propose through Twine. Answer the right questions or...
or you die. Yes.
Great. Well, thanks to the Guardian team and Lee Alexander. Where can people find out more about you?
My work and my various projects are regularly linked at my website, leealexander.net. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
When it comes to robotics, the future may already be here, if just a little bit out of sight. They clean carpets, milk cows, find explosives and build cars, and explore our solar system. But they are mostly discreet, behind factory doors or in outer space. Not so the plucky pint-sized human robot Asimo, the now 10-year-old creation of carmaker Honda's robotics team. Asimo is an astronaut-like figure who's the pinnacle of over three decades of research, rolled out to show off Honda's know-how to advocate for a future more commonly seen in the movies of robots as both helpers and friends. Ahead of Asimo's public appearance at the Wired Tech Conference in London, I met up with Vicky Hood from Honda to find out more. And I started out by asking her to paint a picture of what little Asimo looks like.
Asimo is around, it was exactly 130 centimetres tall. So it's the size of a seated adult or a child, which is obviously an intentional decision. It means that Asimo can function very well within a household environment, switching light switches, picking things up off a table, putting things in a cupboard. But also it's not scary or intimidating, and it's not too going to take up too much space either. Asimo is made of a polyfiber plastic, but it's quite soft to the touch, so it's quite a pleasant experience to touch Asimo. Asimo has a few indicator lights on his front and a small visor which covers Asimo's face.
That's interesting. I didn't realise he was soft touch.
Yeah, it's quite a pleasant experience to touch Asimo.
Tactile robots. Okay. When it goes around the country and doing tours and things like that, and people come and see it, what's the general reaction from the public to Asimo? I mean, is it wow, awe, and how do kids react to it? Having, you know, they don't have any preconceived ideas of how a robot should be.
Yes, children are generally more accepting, I would say, of robots. Of course, you get the occasional one who's a little bit nervous at first, but for the most part, children are like, well, of course, it's a walking, talking robot, just the way they might be if you showed them a unicorn. So they're definitely more accepting of it than adults. Although in general, the reception to Asimo is overwhelmingly positive, which is partly why we do these demonstration programs in Europe, because we want to make sure that people can get that first-hand experience and realize that it isn't as scary as it might feel when you haven't seen it. Generally, yeah, everybody's very positive.
And so in the robotics program, the focus for the outside world is obviously the little robot that could, Asimo. But is there more behind Honda's robotics?
Definitely. Asimo is, as you say, a very recognisable kind of front for that robotics programme. But there's all kinds of spin-off technologies that have been developed through our research into humanoid robots, ranging from safety technologies that are in our cars today through to disaster relief robots that are in use at Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan.
So how long has Honda been in robotics? Give us a quick overview of the history of Asimo and his fellow compatriots.
Honda's robotics research began back in 1986. So the current version of Asimo is really the culmination of almost 30 years worth of research. Asimo in its form that we see now really came to shape in around 2000. But before that, we began with the legs and we studied human walking, which actually basically involves becoming slightly off balance and essentially falling forward. So we spent a lot of time working on the legs before we even began to develop a torso and the arms and legs and head that you see on Asimo today.
I first saw Asimo in 2004 at the Science Museum. I saw it run across the floor in the most human way I'd ever seen. And still today, I don't think I've ever seen a robot move quite like a human. So was that the big step for Asimo?
That was certainly our initial aim. Overall, we want to make Asimo useful in people's daily lives, which means clearly it needs to be able to do more than walk. But we felt it was really important that Asimo could take on walking and indeed running in an autonomous fashion. What makes it different from other humanoid robots or other robots in general is that Asimo's walking motion is exactly, like I said, that of a human, where it falls forward as we do, becoming slightly off balance, which means that it can adapt itself and its balancing can conditions very much to a human environment.
I read that its airborne time is 0.08 seconds per step, something like that.
That's good knowledge. When Asimo's running, it does indeed. Both feet are off the ground at the same time for just under a half a second.
And so why is walking so important? I mean, robots can have wheels. I mean, they're not human. So why saddle them with the inefficiencies of human walking?
We feel that it's really important that any humanoid robot can work in harmony with people. And that means that it needs to be really comfortable in a human environment. Giving Asimo two legs and enabling it to walk and run means that it can navigate its way through the home, through crowded environments, and adjust its course exactly like we would. It also makes it feel a little bit more personable to those around it.
That brings me to the modern robotics. We've seen many robots enter our lives, but actually the sci-fi annuals are a bit off. We've still got, of course, the humanoid robots, but most of the robots that we see and use today are much smaller, in the background style. Do you think we're ever actually going to get to the point where Asimo comes in and does the cleaning for us, rather than a little robotic Hoover like the recently launched Dyson i?
We're still a long way off from that, in all honesty. We've got a lot of work to do. We've obviously made huge progressions even since introducing Asimo, but we've got lots more to do, both in terms of physical capabilities, refining those, but predominantly in terms of its intelligence. Asimo can perform a number of tasks autonomously now. It can recognize people speaking simultaneously and discern what each one was saying, but it's still got a lot to do, and that's a lot down to the fact that we are still learning about the human brain. So until we fully understand that, it's very hard to replicate that. And obviously there's also lots to think about in terms of how we see robots fitting in society, making sure that they can work in harmony with people and that it's as practical and as useful as possible.
We've seen artificial intelligence really come to the forefront. When Google bought DeepMind last year, it was a big kind of shock to the system. Oh wow, this is something that's actually being used in our everyday lives. How does Honda see the developments in our outside? I mean, we as I say, we've seen Google really push the robotics forward. It made purchases and it's started its own kind of moonshot division in robotics. Is that healthy competition, or is there something interlinked with Honda?
Certainly for Honda, as I said, we see robotics as an integral part of human future. We want to make sure that our robots interact well with people, and we're focusing on kind of creating an overall package. So there's all kinds of robotics research out there where people are focusing on robotic arms or different specific elements of robotics technology. What we're trying to create is an overall package that means that Asimo or its future generations can be really useful to people.
So in the Honda, of course, we know it in the UK as an automotive manufacturer. Is Asimo on the manufacturing floor, you know, pushing in bolts or at least some of his siblings?
No, we don't use Asimo to manufacture any of our other products. However, we do have some of the technology that's been developed to work on Asimo in use in Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. After the earthquake in 2011, we started working on disaster relief technology in robotics. Obviously, there's a real opportunity for robots to fill a gap where there's environments that might be too dangerous for humans, and that could be anything from kind of high voltage to high altitude work through to working in an environment where you might be exposed to nuclear radiation.
So the cleanup effort is still ongoing. How many robots has Honda got operating in that kind of environment?
So at the moment, we only have the one, and that robot is basically responsible for performing surveys within one of the reactor buildings at Fukushima. That robot operates in an environment that would otherwise be quite difficult for people. It doesn't look like Asimo. It looks like a very big robotic arm on a kind of caterpillar leg. So it's not a direct humanoid robot, although that is something that we are investigating in terms of humanoid disaster relief robots. So could Asimo be sort of helping out in disaster recovery scenarios?
And so the new Asimo, the 2014 Asimo, is going to appear at Wired this week. Can you tell us a little bit about what more it can do now?
Sure. We call it the all-new Asimo. Oh. So the all-new Asimo has made significant developments in physical and intelligence capabilities. In terms of its physical improvements, it's basically faster and smoother. So Asimo can run now up to 9 kilometres an hour, which is, I think, about 5.5 miles an hour.
So in human terms, what's that? Is that a quick march?
That's equivalent to a human jog. Okay. So Asimo could keep up with you jogging around the park. It also broke its own record as the fastest humanoid robot with its latest speed. So it's definitely one to watch in a race. But Asimo can also, as part of that development, it can now move very seamlessly between running and walking and adjust the length of its stride and its pace very easily, which means that, as I was talking about earlier, it's really important to us that it can integrate into society. So having that ability to quickly change its direction, its speed, makes it safe and viable as operating in a human environment. It can also hop and jump up and down on both legs, which is something quite unique for a humanoid robot as well.
So, I mean, we've seen a lot of people have a kind of an innate fear towards robotics, mainly because it's the, oh no, it's going to steal my job mentality. I mean, could Asimo replace me? Could it write a scribe and you know, is it going to replace our jobs anytime soon?
The short answer is definitely no. You know, Honda's objective is very much to work in harmony with people. If you take Japan, for an example, they have an aging population. So at the moment, there is a lot of burden and strain on the younger generations to look after their elderly, plus obviously having full-time jobs and all the rest. So we see Asimo as a partner in the home, something that can help you to look after your elderly relatives, who can perhaps help your children with their homework or help you with the daily chores, rather than a robot that's going to move in and start writing your articles for you and leave you out on the street.
oh, if only it would just, you know, help me write a few things. I'm sure I could just put my byline on it. It'd be fine. So the way robotics is going, it seems miles off. But if somebody wanted to say, I don't know, they really want a humanoid robot, and the small toys just don't cut it. How far away, just getting crystal ball out, how far are we away from the, you know, from the millionaire's robot? Not necessarily the consumer robot, but if a millionaire, say Richard Branson wanted a robot, when could he get one?
In terms of Honda, as I said, we haven't placed a timeline against it yet, but I would urge that certainly something we see as future technology, and it's something we want to implement. It's not just a kind of a demonstration project. However, there is a long way to go. So we don't see it as a short or potentially even a midterm. You know, you have to look a little bit further. In the short to midterm, we're using those technologies to generate things like walking assist devices that help people who have got weakened leg muscles. So all of those technologies are continuing to evolve, both towards that future goal and also towards generating products and technology in the here and now. But we're still a good few years off.
So start saving now is what you're saying? Yeah. 50 years?
You know? Yeah, maybe.
Okay. I mean, you talked about walking assist systems. I mean, mm-hmm. We don't see much of that in the UK. Is that something that's big in Japan? I mean, and what kind of things can you buy? I mean, we have, when somebody thinks about a walking assist system, they're probably thinking almost the exoskeleton from Alien and Ripley grabbing the thing and chucking people off, you know, the alien out of the airlock. But where are we in the real life?
So in the real world, we've got two walking assist devices. One of those is a stride management assist device that basically helps people with weakened leg muscles to make their stride movement. So it takes a little bit of the strain off your leg muscles, but it also means that you are still using them. So it can help maintain people's general kind of physical health better than perhaps being confined to a wheelchair where those muscles would deteriorate much quicker. We also have a body weight assist system, which is designed, it's very similar, but the idea is that it can help take the strain of lifting or bending in repetitive scenarios. So both of these technologies are still very much in the research phase. But in Japan and the US, they are in medical trials. So we are hoping that those technologies can really help real-world patients soon. In terms of body weight assist, that also applies to potentially people who have very physical labour jobs. So maybe they're working in a factory or something like that, and they have to lift heavy pallets repeatedly throughout the day. It can avoid back and leg injuries.
So we really are heading towards the power lifter technology.
It kind of, yes, perhaps slightly less dramatic looking, but it is certainly a kind of an exoskeleton in the sense that it fits around your legs and your waist and helps to assist those movements.
Okay. So just tell me, when was the first time you saw Asimo, and was it your first robot experience?
It certainly was my first robot experience. When I joined Honda, nigh on 8 years ago now, I saw Asimo. Asimo came and visited my offices, and
you come and say hello.
Kind of, yes. And I had my photo taken with it, and I was totally blown away. And I must admit that although I work with Asimo pretty much every day now, I am still amazed by it. And certainly every time we make new advancements in the technology, it's still just as exciting as it was the first time. There's something quite special about it. I'm lucky enough to shake hands with a robot on a regular basis, and it still feels like a pretty special experience.
Are there lots of selfie opportunities? I mean, does it form quite a large part of your life?
I certainly have had an Asimo selfie, I'm not going to lie. You can't help but form a bond. You know, whenever I demonstrate Asimo around Europe, we talk about the fact that it is a robot. You know, shaking hands is not something we ever need to do with a robot. But at the same time, as you touched upon, there is often a lot of fear and reticence about robots and the kind of the unknown. And part of the reason that Asimo looks the the way it does and moves the way it does is to help put people at ease. And I think that it definitely does that effectively. I have certainly a soft spot for it.
So if somebody wants to actually see it in person, where can they?
Well, Thursday and Friday of this week will be at Wired, which is taking place at Tobacco Docks. We'll be demonstrating ASMO in their tech lab environment for people to come and see.
And can they get a selfie with it?
I think it might be a bit difficult to promise a selfie.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you on this week's show. Thanks again to Vicky Hood and the tech team this week, Charles Arthur, Alex Hearn and Leah Alexander. Remember, for breaking news and reviews day and night, just go to theguardian.com/technology. But from me, Samuel Gibbs, and the producer, Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Ta-ra!
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.